So good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
So I want to talk tonight about two koans, the other two koans that were on the talk handout, the two Shens and Layman Pang and Lang Zhao. And I think they're both related in some way to some of the things we said about the Surangama Sutra koan, because they both have something to do with being held in that vastness that maybe isn't exactly something that we can see and isn't an object set over against us, but instead comes right up through us and is everything and everywhere. If it's okay, I don't think I'm going to read the folktale again, though it's mostly the folktale that I want to talk about, but it took two or three pages, and I trust that you remember the parts that you want to remember. So here's the koan, which is really pretty short. Wuzu asked a monk, "The woman Shen and her spirit separated, which is the true Chan?" Well, in a way, we know that the way you answer a question like that in Zen is you just say yes, so we can do that. But I'm really interested in reading the folk tale and what the koan itself does or doesn't seem to get at. I talked with one person in work in the room today who shared my sense that in some odd way there's something really more moving about the folk tale than about the koan itself, though some of the commentaries pick up on some of what's in the folktale. So the koan just says, the woman Shen and her spirit separated. And kind of strangely, as I understand the commentaries, when it's read that way, it turns out that the woman who went away with her lover to get married and raise kids is the spirit, whereas the empty shell lying in bed, or the person meditating or dreaming lying in bed, is the self or the body. So Shibayama says, paraphrasing that reading, which he seems partly to be interested in and partly to move away from, he says, one of the Chens talking to another one, "Now I see your soul left your..." the father, I guess. "Now I see your soul left your body and has been with Ochu." So in some way, I think that's a very beautiful story, and it's a story that's important to Zen practice. So it's something about a split between a self and soul, or between form and emptiness, or about yourself walking around and any connection with the vastness. And it's possible, certainly, to read the story, to read the koan and the story as a resolution of that split and as a kind of parable of what can happen through Zen practice. And I think certainly awakening can sometimes feel like that and have a quality of it. And so it is a kind of moving parable about that part of our practice. I was thinking about that, and I thought if I were sitting with it that way, I would probably think of the one sitting here who I am as the self waiting for the soul to meld into me. But then it occurred to me sometimes it might turn out that I thought I was the vastness or the spirit waiting for myself to come back. But at any rate, that's one way to take the koan and the parable, the fable. At the same time, in the literary critical business, the notion that the woman who ran away with her husband is the spirit or the vastness would be called kind of bad allegorizing. You know, so it's one of those moments in the Zen tradition where clearly they're taking the story from outside the tradition and doing something with it. And it's a little bit strange in a way. You know, so if you were to say to the woman off in the other place with her husband raising two kids, "Well, you're the vastness and you're the spirit, you know, but where's yourself?" She would say what? You know, it seems really strange to regard that as a, you know, a kind of symbol of the vastness or spirit. So maybe in another way, and I know this has come up in some conversations that we've had over the few days, it's also possible to think about the fable, maybe if not the way it's allegorized in the koan, as just two possible selves, one possible life and another possible life. And I think that's probably a more resonant way to read it, and it's certainly the one that pulls on me and that I find a little strange and hard to understand. So I'm going to be working with that. Shibayama, in another part of his commentary, seems to kind of move in that direction, though he actually slides through something else, that a little thing that I would call kind of a strange allegorizing of this moment. He says, "If you can personally attain to the truth of this koan, then you will be able to declare that to live is to be a form of your true self at one time and at one place, and to die is also to be a form of your true self at one time and at one place, life and death are not two different things. So there he seems to be allegorizing one Chan as the live one and one as the dead one. So I think it's really more useful just to say the Chan in bed is one form of your true self, and the Chan who's off with her husband and the kids is another form of her true self. And then Shibayama says this quite beautiful thing. It may be just like big and small waves in the ocean. The true one or the truth can be likened to the water itself. The water can take various forms as waves, now a billow, now a ripple. From the standpoint of the water, each wave is its form at a certain time and place. After all, the fact that they are all water does not change. So in that reading, we have two Chens, two possible lives, both emanating from and being incarnations and returning to the true self or the vast and the eternal or the ocean that's always rising up into and as a myriad of forms. And you can't ever set that over against you because you are it. So in that sense, there's the affinity I see between Nisko'an and the Surangama's place of not seeing. Why isn't it you? I want to turn now to the magical folktale aspect of the story, which I haven't focused on yet. So she goes off with her lover, she leaves the daughter self at home with the parents that she's loyal to, and one falls into a stupor or a coma or a sleep, and then through the efforts of the vitally alive but regretful one, and also with a big hand up from a whole bunch of magic, they become reunited and they become one. So in our tradition, I know one way that's read, and I think it's really important, though it's not where I want to land finally, is psychologically. So it's read as a parable of the psychology of being a person. And in that sense, the koan would be about the imperative to make whole what you can make whole. And I think that's really important, not to abandon or repudiate more feelings or impulses or loyalties or enthusiasms than you have to. And in some sense, not to renounce or turn away from other selves that you were or you used to be, but have somehow abandoned. And one of the ways I know this is something the Koans sometimes talked about in those terms is there's a little odd as an image, but there's the kind of active self who's involved in raising kids, and then the one in bed who's in a coma is sometimes regarded as more meditative, which in a way might be true. And so you can read that as an attempt, you know, to sort of heal those parts of yourself that are out in the world doing things, and the more contemplative or meditative or poetic part of yourself. And that's certainly a very real thing for a number of us. I know it is for me. And I think in that sense, the parable suggests that sometimes, as if by magic, you really can't heal that split. You can go back and retrieve other selves you wanted to be, other impulses, other loves, other loyalties, and really bring them into your actual life. And I think beyond that, it also suggests that even if you can't do that, that in a really important sense, it's a good thing to keep faith with several of those. Obviously, not all of them, not every place you might have been or everything you might have loved is something you need to reintegrate. But the imperative to do that seems pretty strong and pretty valuable. And in that sense, the magic would be a kind of hyperbolic version of that. You know, I can't literally bring them together, but I can hold them both in my heart. And so the koan is often worked with in terms of that kind of something that we might call healing. And I think that's really important. At the same time, Shibayama's image of the big ocean feels kind of cosmic or metaphysical and not just like the space of all possible psyches. Okay, so it seems to have something to do with the place from which all lives come and to which they return. The place from which all lives come, first of all actual lives, but then in the strange terminology and fable of the story, also the big ocean is that kind of cosmic place which from which all possible life comes as well, all possible selves and all possible versions of yourself. And the waves rising and subsiding are like those various lives that you either are living or you might have lived or you did live once. And there's also, therefore, this is a really different kind of image, but there's something like Borges' vision of these infinitely forking paths. You know, there's the path that you became, and then there are all these other lives that you didn't take, that you abandoned, and so on. And what I want to suggest is not exactly like a psychological healing of those things. And I want to get to the other possibility through a story that Joan used to tell, which I really like. It's a pretty short little anecdote. I think it's a Brooklyn story. It sounds like a Brooklyn mom to me. But she knew somebody named Stevie. Probably a lot of you remember this. And the mother used to say, The trouble with you, Stevie, is you take your life too personally, which is just really great. And then John would laugh and say, yes, yes, you know, but it's actually a really deep Dharma point. The trouble with you, Stevie, is you take your life too personally. And so I have a lot of trouble articulating the ways in which the Two Chen story and these multiple selves gets at something like that attitude. So I'm going to try kind of multiple tries or formulations of that. Okay. So in one way, it's as if each possible Tenny life, to talk about myself, is one of many, and I might well have followed another path in the multitude of forking and reforking paths. And for me, the shiver that provokes has something to do with the dreamlike nature of any life which it suggests, including the particular Tenny life which I'm living. And it's as if over there are other possible Tenny lives going on in some other dream life, some other dream of reality. And in this dreamlike quality, there's also a slight sense of distance from myself and from the particular life I'm living. And I think it's really important that it's not a critical distance. If I get the distance of, here's one possible Tenny, I mean, sometimes I'll criticize it for sure, but there's something else that's more reflective or a little strange just about that distance between myself and the particular life that I'm living. And to continue just a little bit trying to get at what I'm trying to suggest, I would say that what I'm talking about at this part of the talk is really a metaphor or a myth or a fable, and that I don't think it's literally quite true, but for me it's a good fable. Wallace Stevens, the poet, talks about the necessity to believe in a fiction which we know to be a fiction. So this would be a fiction that I find useful at least now. You know. So I might have lived other Tenny lives, and so in a way I'm the steward or the one taking care of the particular life I'm living, the particular life that I've made so far and that I go on making. And this particular Tenny life is one emanation of the ocean, the vastness. It's one of the many possible Tenny lives I might have lived, some of which I started to live and then the path forked off. And what happened to those other forks not taken and those other selves, and where are they? And what might it be like to live the life I'm living, the fork that I took, in something like this spirit? If it's one of many possible lives, perhaps this life that I'm living owes something to the Tennies that didn't materialize, the Tennies that I abandoned. And I'm not talking really in a psychological sense here, I'm just saying in some sense to walk with them, as if I should live this Tenny life for them too and on their behalf. And that I'll try to carry those other lives along with the one I have so they can live through me. I think that's a little crazy in a way, but for me it's a strangely resonant way of interacting with the koan, and it gets at something like this, which seems, you know, closer to what Joan was talking about and less of a parable or a fable. That the particular life I'm living is just a life, and in some way it's my task to live it that way and to care for the dignity and the pathos and the rumpus of any life at all by caring for the particular one I happen to be living. So that this life flows right out of the center, where I might have been me or another me, or I might have been you, or I might have been my dog, or a cactus, or a rock in the sun. And if we take the reincarnation story as a story or a fable, which maybe it is and maybe it isn't, I think that's partly what it's getting at, that sense of the life I'm living as just a life, finally. So the trouble with you, Stevie, is you take your life too personally. And the koan really resonates with that for me. So to be a little more lightsome about it, maybe, here's just a part of a poem by Frank O'Hara, who it was a poem from about the 1950s. It was a New York City poet. It's called A Step Away From Them. And he's really notable as a Mobius strip kind of poet, so that one sense of what it is to be a person will morph into another one. And I'm just gonna read part of this, but I'll just say, you know, to kind of clue you in, since I'm only reading parts, the beginning is kind of, oh, I'm just Frank, I'm just an ordinary guy. And then something turns, and it's as if that vast perspective where it's just a life, the particular life he's living, is just a life, and he feels it that way, comes into the poem. So it starts this way. It's my lunch hour, so I go for a walk among the hum-colored cabs. First down the sidewalk, where laborers feed their dirty, glistening torsos sandwiches and Coca-Cola with yellow helmets on. They protect them from falling bricks, I guess. And then that goes on like that for about another 20 lines. And he used to call those poems my I do this, I do that poems. So just ordinary daily occurrences. And then something, I'll tell you, I was going to skip this, but I'll tell you that the reason not to say it is it reads like a bad sort of romantic version of racism, because he says something about Puerto Ricans. And I think we wouldn't say it this way anymore, but I think what's behind it is that Latin cultures in New York, a lot more of the home life sort of spills out into the street. So you see people drinking beer and playing dominoes. And there's a kind of intimacy and warmth to that. So anyway, the part which I'll try to do from memory, because I didn't write it down, but I want to read it anyway. He says, there's several Puerto Ricans on the avenue today, which makes it beautiful and warm. And then there are the names of three friends, and a couple of them are nicknames, and one's a famous painter, but, you know, they're okay. There's several Puerto Ricans on the avenue today, which makes it beautiful and warm. So out of that warmth, and something opens the way it would in retreat, makes it beautiful and warm. First Bunny died, and the poem has had nothing to do with death. First Bunny died, then John Latouche, then Jackson Pollock. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? And one is eaten and one walks, and then the poem goes on, you know. So the strength, the recollection, the, first this warmth and this softening, and then the recent death of these various friends, you know, who at least one or two of them were quite close to him and he knew them all pretty well. And then this strange question where everything all of a sudden gets very compressed and elliptical and Cohen-like. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? And that might be, you know, is the earth I'm walking around in, but I think that would be the world. And I think it's really the earth. Is the earth where they are as full as life was full of them? So where did they go? Where did that life go? What happened to it? And right after that, and one of the great things about him as a poet is he can do this without making it seem schmaltzy. It's not, and so I've eaten and I walk. It's, and one is eaten and one walks. And that one is the anyone in that moment. And so that life just on a dime turns into any life. You know, so the trouble with you, Frank, is you take yourself too personally, and then he doesn't. So I think it's really important to our status as a both and school to not think of that as a one-way street. I used to think of myself as Frank, and now I'm one. It's really important that it dives right back in, and the poem does in that way. So I'll give you a talking dirtier version of the same thing. There's another poem that he writes earlier called, I don't know if it's earlier, Ode to Michael Goldberg's Birth and Other Births. And O'Hara says in one place that one thing he loves is love's life-giving vulgarity. So when you're in love with people, it's really magnificent, but it's also just kind of down to earth. And so there's this great moment where I think he's remembering himself as a teenager, and he says, yippee, I'm glad I'm alive, which is, you know, in a way that's particular, but that's the vastness coming right up through him. And then this is not a lot like Lehman Pong, but it's a little bit like Lehman Pong. Then his boyfriend of the moment says, I'm glad you're alive too, baby, because I want to fuck you. You know, so that's that moment exactly of going from the grand just right back to the everyday, you know. So we dive back in to the particular thing and the particular life. And nevertheless, it's still just the life. So that's one going down and one to go. And this one will be shorter. Because we did most of the work of the talk last night in the Cohen seminar. So with Lehman Pong, this is just a little attempt to turn things back outward the way we do the last night of a retreat toward the world right now that's seething out there beyond our monastery. And I'm going to do that in a kind of abstract way. I'm just going to talk about the kind of vantage of the Cohen. And we can talk that way for the rest of the night if we want, or if you want to take it as an invitation, you know, to let in the Attorney General and stuff like that. I mean, that's fine. You know, whichever way we go is good. And I want to remind you again, as I keep reminding people, and mostly you know this, Joan reminds us that the Cohen tradition originated in the aftermath of the An Lushan Rebellion in China in roughly the 8th century, I think it is, when something like 2/3 of every single person in China died in a series of rebellions and wars. And her understanding of the Cohen tradition as it's developed by Shitto, who's the taking part in the gathering person that we read, and Great Master Ma, is that the koans were there attemptually to bring Zen into engagement with that seething world beyond the monastery. And Jun says that those teachers lifted the eyes of Chan to the horizon instead of sort of gazing down at the floor. And she also likes to quote Great Master Ma apparently saying to somebody who came to his monastery seeking refuge in this time of trouble and for whatever other reason, the person asked him, "What's the meaning of your school?" And Ma said, apparently, "It's just the place where you lose your body and your life." And as Joan says, that was a very, very serious thing to say when two out of every three people had died. So the Koan tradition is aimed at situations like the one we're in right now, and much more dire ones. So here's the koan. Right? One day, Layman Pong and his daughter Ling Zhao, spirit shining, were out selling bamboo baskets. Coming down off a bridge, he stumbled and fell. When Ling Zhao saw this, she ran to her father's side and threw herself to the ground. "What are you doing?" cried the layman. "I saw you fall, so I'm helping," replied Ling Zhao. "Lucky no one was looking," remarked the layman. So here's some of the things we talked about, and I'll just recap really briefly. What is this helping, and what on earth is going on with the lucky no one was looking? And so as we said last night, the question of how one can be helpful really depends. And sometimes you can be of great practical help, and sometimes you just fall with the person who's falling, and that's what's most helpful. And I won't retell the story of the person falling in the Kenyan line behind the person who fell, but that kind of immediacy is something that's important and that we talked about last night. So what about the luckily no one was looking? I want to spend a little bit of time with that. So what are some of the things we said last night? First of all, and I think this is really crucial to the koan, everyone was involved, everyone was responsive, everyone was fetched and fetchable and fetched, I guess I would say, and they weren't trying in some way to scope out the deep meaning of the situation or to be analytical about it. I thought a little more about what Piper said last night, and I think here's what I understand. I can't remember anymore if you said this or if I just misheard you, but I think you said something like that, as the reader, you're also not looking. But in any case, I think that's really important that the koan does. So if the koans are designed not simply to teach us something, but to pass on to us what's true of the people in the koan does not want to make for us a point that we can understand about a particular kind of involvement. It wants us to fall right in behind Ling Zhao. Yeah. And I think, and in a way, that's sort of the decent response to the koan. And the other one, you know, it's not really voyeuristic, but it has that quality of removal that might be a problem. And then also, as we said, and I think this is, you know, John and other people were talking about this, just the kind of vernacular and sort of jokey quality of luckily no one was looking is really sweet and really intimate. And I think that's, you know, as important as anything else in the koan, the sweetness of that moment and the way in which the kind of gruffness makes it a little bit light and makes it something that they can sort of get up and carry with them in a way that's not too solemn. You know, the more solemn things that he might have said that wouldn't have been quite as beautiful. So I'm going to read a couple other things before I'm done, but I just want to say before I read them just a couple more things about the koan. And I'm recapping here a conversation that happened in the hall at Okamura one year, just that we were working on this koan. And I'm going to do it in reverse order because it's my retreat, so I get to have the last word, even though Joan's the Roshi, you know. So I said, "Oh, I want to tell you, actually, I have this other thing about the koan. I don't know what, you know, but I think I want to say it." And then Joan sort of said, "Well, okay, since you said that, I'll give you my sort of secret thing about the koan, right?" And so her secret thing about the koan, which I think is really wonderful, is that at the same time as the luckily no one was looking, she said everything is looking. The cactus is looking, the birds are looking, the rocks are looking, the sky is looking. And so the other side of this incredibly intimate moment is the sense of everything interpermeated, everything aware of everything else, that sort of warm universe of reciprocal awarenesses that she used to talk about. And again, that doesn't violate, but again, the two sides of the Mobius strip. When everything is looking that way, there's still that sweetness of luckily no one was looking. And both those things are true. So my reading is in a way a little geekier, at least as a start. And I look at the phrase, luckily no one was looking, and I wonder about that no one. And I kind of read it in a contrary way, and I say, oh, no one was actually looking. There is a no one who was looking. And that's that vantage of the vastness, like the space of the Surangama Sutra, where there's something that's not a person, we don't know what to call it, but everything is sort of held in that perspective, you know. And so my vantage and your vantage and Layman Pong's vantage and Ling Xiao's vantage are held in and by that ocean where no one is looking. And we can feel that vast stillness flowing up through us, the ocean of which were waves. Why do we call it no one? I think that's part of the Zen tradition. You know, we don't say the big guy is looking out for us. I mean, we might say that or we might not. But still, there's an incredible, strange consolation in the no one who's looking. Just that emptiness, just that vastness, just that stillness that's registering everything, that's looking in some way. And I think also we can, in some way, occupy the place of that no one. And that's the strange thing about the koan, that you can get a sense of that vast perspective that holds it all, and you can feel that that vast perspective is a perspective you're also occupying. So I think that's important. And I think Zen practice is one way to get there, though there must be a million other places. But to be able to occupy the place of that no one is really important. And the kicker, and it's the same kicker that I've been mentioning, is as soon as you think that that's where you're going to go, you lose it. That unless you throw it right back into motion, unless you dive right back on the floor with Ling Xiao, you won't hold the place of that no one anymore. That the paradox is you can only hold the vantage of that no one as you dive right back in to your own particular life and your relations, and one would hope your compassion. All right. So I want to read two things. One is Norman Fisher. It won't take very long. Norman Fisher talking about something that I take to be very like these sort of two vantages, the engaged vantage, the vantage of falling when your father falls, and the place of the no one. And he talks about it in terms of bodhicitta, the desire or the impulse for spiritual awakening, and he makes a distinction between absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. And it's not at all as technical as it sounds when he starts explaining it. So he says, absolute bodhicitta is absolute love, love that's bigger than any emotion, bigger than any object, so big that there is no lover and no beloved. The two merge into one under absolute love's force. Love that amounts to a total vision of life as love itself. Within such love, there can be no loss, because this love is so big it includes everything, even absence, so that nothing can ever be lost. Absolute bodhicitta is the empty, perfect, expansive, joyful, spacious nature of existence itself. Nor is it something that we have added on to existence. It's always been there in life, as life. It's always been the nature of how things are. Love has been there all along, but we've been so convinced by our smallness that we have failed to look around and notice it. In contrast to this exalted state and exalted view, relative bodhicitta involves our doing a bit of work. Relative bodhicitta is when I roll up my sleeves and get on with the business of actually loving somebody. You may be feeling exhausted just here, and he's been talking about relative bodhicitta, so he made it feel exhausting, right? You may be feeling exhausted just hearing about relative bodhicitta, but actually relative bodhicitta is the antidote to fatigue because it is built on a foundation of absolute bodhicitta. If relative bodhicitta is an endless task, absolute bodhicitta is the endless peace that underlies that endless task, so it's okay. So absolute and relative bodhicitta depend on each other as two sides of a coin. Without absolute bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta will become forced, and we will become angry and worn out with all of our caring and all of our helping. And without relative bodhicitta, absolute bodhicitta becomes a kind of grand abstraction, a big lofty religious idea with no substance to it. What good is a really big love if it never gets applied to the world? What good is a big love if we never love anyone, if we never support anyone? And when we do love someone, when we do support someone, we become awakened thanks to that person or those people. We become liberated from the dream of self-clinging. we become truly and lastingly happy. And I want to suggest that that double perspective, which is what I was also trying to suggest through the talking about the layman pan koan, is really crucial in times like these. I want to do one other thing. I think there's such an impulse now to think we have to do everything, or to feel that if we can't do everything, we're not doing anything. So here's Joan from the wonderful recently published book, Vimalakirti and the Awakened Heart, with that wonderful zany catalog of all the bodhisattvas. So here's the run-up to it. Vimalakirti implies that we bodhisattvas in training should avoid thinking of the bodhisattva as a template of perfection we're going to squeeze ourselves into. In an off-balance world that invites our flexibility and improvisation, there are a lot of different ways to be a bodhisattva, and the sutra names many of them. I used to think that this was just part of the tendency in the old texts to elaborate the chiliocosms upon chiliocosms and all the wonderful jewels, flowers, music. So there are all these lists in the sutras that just go on for pages and pages. But now I think this is actually a deep Dharma point. There isn't a bodhicitta, there isn't a bodhisattva, there are unblinking bodhisattvas, wonderful arm bodhisattva, jewel hand bodhisattva, lion mind bodhisattva, pure emancipation bodhisattva, universal maintenance bodhisattva, jewel courage bodhisattva, roots of joy bodhisattva, joyful vision bodhisattva, sounds of thunder bodhisattva, serene capacity bodhisattva, store of virtue bodhisattva, delights in the real bodhisattva. And then there are three that clearly show the absence of a single template for our spiritual lives. Viewing equality bodhisattva, viewing inequality bodhisattva, and viewing equality and inequality bodhisattva. This is just a fraction of the titles in the sutra, and the invitation is to discover your particular expression of bodhisattvaness. In the tilti world, you figure out whether you're jewel hand bodhisattva or roots of joy bodhisattva, understanding that you might be different bodhisattvas at different times in your life, and maybe more often than not, feeling a bit humble about it at all. Fingers crossed bodhisattva, pretty close bodhisattva, not a bad morning bodhisattva, flying by the seat of my pants bodhisattva. So, thank you. So we have some time for conversation if we'd like to have it.
Well, can we talk about the elephant in the room? No one that was watching. I was going to bring this into the room, and I had similar thoughts on it. Mainly that those things that you mentioned that encompass no one. One of them is the daughter. And I felt like that was the compliment he was giving her was she was one of the no ones, you know.
That's really sweet. That's great. Thank you, John. Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah, because that really unites that sort of, you know, the vastness. Yeah. Absolutely stitches it into something really intimate. That's beautiful. Thank you.
I felt like Jen, you know, there was something there that I just wasn't getting to. And then just after we talked last time, when I came back in here, I was thinking about that calling. But just for some reason that came to me.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought about it last night too. That no one he was referring to. To the daughter, and I love Shibayama's thing with the ocean and the wave. And it recalled to me that, when we were talking about Joan's secret, and how it was, everything was actually looking. So I thought that when you said that, and then you said your secret thing, I thought they were the same thing.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
And if you go back to Shibayama's wave.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. But that's a Mobius strip thing, then, to see them as the same thing in some way.
Yeah, it's the same, I mean, it is that wave.
So they say.
I thought the elephant in the room was, you know, like the Attorney General.
Oh, yeah. We could bring that elephant in, too, if we want.
Well, I don't want to. That's okay. But I wonder if I'm the only one who's afraid of it. I mean, I do want to, but I don't want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Attorney General mean that?
That's just who Tanya used as...
Yeah, just all the stuff that's going on.
Sure. Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think that Joan's thing is just perfect for this moment, you know. Because everybody's going to find a different way to be useful. You know?
But if you... How is it different? I mean... It's like it's a matter of degree, and if you were already sort of in that place of dilemma of how to be useful and how to be useful while still maintaining your, you know, whatever center you need to maintain to even feel like you can be, have anything to give, you know, if that was already kind of, what now? You know, how is it different?
Yeah.
Just that sort of sense that somehow now we need to do more. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And is there a way to just...
Yeah.
Has something changed?
Yeah.
Or not?
Does anybody else want to engage that? I mean... I tend to have a feeling like if I can't do everything, then I'm not doing anything. Or if I'm not doing this thing that I think I should be doing, but it doesn't feel like something that I really think I can do, mm-hmm. you know, given who I am, mm-hmm. then that doesn't have to be incapacitating, that I'll find my ways mm-hmm. to be of use and they won't be your ways, mm-hmm. you know. And also, I mean, in a way, it's too easy to say this, so I hope it turns out to be true in some way, but that what Norman calls the absolute bodhicitta does provide a kind of vantage from which we can do that better and gives us a little more resiliency than we might otherwise have had. And so that would be something about, you know, why should we be sitting on retreat mm-hmm. when everything that's going on is going on? And, you know, I mean, again, it's really easy for that to become too easy, I think.
I had this big wave of sadness when you were saying, talking about, you were reading about how, about the relative and how when you're, I don't remember what it was exactly, but when you're helping someone, it frees you.
Yeah.
You know, when you completely, because of repeated experiences where I've actually had that feeling of being in an intimate way able to help someone, and it was freeing in terms of, you know, having resources that I didn't know I had and all that, but then they die.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know,
yeah.
that sense of in a sense, even though it was such a terrible thing to be going through, I was happy in a way that I'm not always.
Yeah.
And that seemed what you, how you read that expressed exactly that feeling of being fully, you know, engaged and free.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Yeah.
But how did you feel about being able to be there for them before they died?
That's still a good thing. I mean that.
Yeah.
That. You wouldn't have wanted it to be have not happened. You know?
Right. I mean, I've heard this from so many teachers that, you know, when you are down and out, or you're stuck, or you're, you know, whatever hell you're in, that if you help somebody else, that essentially it will pull you out. Will pull you out. That action will pull you out of that hell.
Yeah.
And so, really, ultimately, you're helping yourself and helping somebody else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm, you know, an answer, or one thought, not an answer, one thought that I have, you know, that I hold, because even helping is very confusing right now. I mean, we're talking about not knowing how that, but what we can do, and what we have, this practice gives us the strength to do, I believe, is to not turn away. And a whole bunch of the world is turning away, all over, you know, flipping. I mean, that's what it feels like to me, just these shutters closing and people turning out of fear, out of judgment, you know, a whole bunch of things. But so to, in the smallest ways, in my own life, and whether it's listening to the news, which makes me, you know, the rhetorical, the way of speaking is so, you know, so much what I want to turn away from. So how to stay in that without letting it, you know, completely overwhelm me. So hold both, I guess is what I'm saying, and not turn away. And so that's sort of my supreme mantra, just not turn away. I might have to say that 1,000 times a day.
I'm just really appreciating your question of, you know, what's the difference now?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a matter of degree, and there's, you know, some, I don't know, just that question I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. And a little bit when what you were talking about after that, I don't know how this is and whether it's at all for you, but it feels a little bit like an answer to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the engaging that you did do even though the person died.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow that feels a little bit like part of the answer. So I appreciate all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember where this is, it may be in the Vimalakirti, but do you remember Joan has really, really good things to say about, in some sense, not being attached to the outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You're talking about compassion?
Yeah.
Action as opposed to a feeling?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah.
In a sense, is it's making me think of the daughter falling down. You know, and that no one's looking. I mean, she's, if you think about him talking to her, she's just falling down.
Mm-hmm.
Like the lady following the, or whoever it was that was following the guy in the Kenhen line, and he falls down, and the person behind him just falls down. You know, it's just that immediate.
Mushin, is that the right term? Mushin, where there's no.
There's
no analytical thought about it. It's just immediate reaction from in here.
A lifelong friend of mine died a couple of years ago, and I had the opportunity to spend the day with him, you know, and there was nothing that you could really do but just be there. I mean, there wasn't anything special that you could do, it seemed to me.
Yeah, it's just an urge or an unexplainable feeling that you have to do something. You know, and it's not a thought out something that, oh, I've got to do something so I can save them, or I've got to do something. I just got to be there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I got to be there, you know. That compassion, you know, it's just...
story about the little girl on the beach and the whole bunch of starfish that are kind of stranded, and she's throwing them back into the ocean. This person comes by and says, you know, you can't make a difference. And she said, I made a difference for that one. Well, that's related to not being attached to the outcome in terms of, you know, solving it. And it's critical not to be attached to the outcome, I think, because if you're attached to the outcome, you'll do things, you know, kind of a ends justify the means kind of thing. You know, you won't be right in what you're doing. But it's a hard balance because, you know, caring about the outcome in some sense is what's motivating you to get involved. And, you know, Piper talked about people turning away. I tend to be sort of surrounded by people who are diving in a way that I don't feel capable of. And I know I'm not capable of some of that, and so, but I'm capable of something. And it's that thing of, you know, how to not turn away, but how to not really, really hurt myself, you know?
Yeah. When you're talking about being attached to the outcome and then not being, dogs are probably easier than people because our relationships with them are somewhat less complicated. But I know the two dogs that I've loved most as a grown-up, you know, when they were really sick and I took care of them for a long time and it really took a while, I was just incredibly attached to the outcome. You know, it's like, you know, maybe she's dying right now. What is this thing that I can do? And it was just incredibly urgent, you know. But then when they were finally dying, I wasn't attached. It was really easy. Not to be, when it wasn't time to be attached to the outcome anymore, in those cases it was really easy not to be attached to the outcome, and or to now to be attached to a different outcome, maybe, you know, now they're actually dying right now, and you know, I didn't,
because you knew you couldn't do anything else.
Yeah, that's
right. And that, I think, is the dilemma when you get out into the wider world, is we don't know what
that's true
could happen.
Yeah,
we don't know what. Yeah. We don't know whether it matters or not how hard we work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so at that point, in a way, you can never stop. Mm-hmm. And so probably you have to find a way to allow yourself to stop when you have to stop anyway. Mm-hmm. Do you know? I mean, if you get some.
Yeah.
And I think that relates to the, it also for me, it harkens back to the story of the young woman, or I forgot her name.
Chen, yeah.
Yeah, of the spirit and the body, and mm-hmm. and your discussion of the idea of you know, we may have had many lives, or we may have many lives, but really, right here, right this moment, we have a life. Which is to say that, for good or for bad, all we can really do is what we're doing right this moment.
Yeah.
You know, and when you get up in the morning, you're going to have a choice what to do between 9 and 10 a.m. But that's all you can choose. And I think it's painful because, and Tenney touched on this, I certainly feel that tendency to be attached to past lives, even if it's just who I was yesterday. You know, did I screw that up? Did I not do enough, you know, about something that happened yesterday or something that happened 40 years ago? And it's a kind of a quandary, but it's also a kind of, in a way, it's a kind of foolishness to be attached to what we may or may not have succeeded at yesterday, you know, because all we really have is right now. I'm just struck by that, because I think behind that question about am I doing enough this moment, inevitably that leads you, you know, it leads to kind of an unending examination of the what ifs, you know, in the past, and it's. I was thinking about all the people who protested against the Vietnam War, you know, 45 years ago. You know, there's probably a lot of people thinking, well, maybe I should have done more, but... So anyway, I, you know, I don't know where I'm going with this. I think one of the hardest things to acknowledge is just how utterly limited and frail we are as beings. We really don't know. We don't even know a fraction of what we think we know, much less what to do about it. Much less do we have the energy and capability of acting on the things that we think we know. I mean, really, it's a humbling thing to consider, and I think it's true. You know, we're all trying, we're sort of gazing out into this murk, you know, trying to decide what to do. And, you know, and I mean, I sometimes really all you can do is look at the person sitting next to you and ask, you know, what's the right thing to do in this second.
Can I go back to one thing that you said? Because it makes me sort of want to try to re-say something that I said. So when you talked about like the various lives that you had and that you might have had, and you know, one of the things I was trying to suggest, and maybe it wasn't clear, is that for me the story of the two Chens, it's a little bit like it provides the place of the no one. I don't know if that was clear, but just like in that moment of total immersion, there's also the vantage of the no one. If I have one life, but I might have had another one, and you know, they're all have a somewhat dreamlike quality because of that, then there's also the sense that I'm seeing them a little bit from the vantage of that no one. You know, that I have something like that kind of perspective on the particular life that I'm living, and that kind of vantage really enables something a little different to happen, maybe. And it has a little bit to do with being less attached to outcomes, maybe. You know, I don't know if that's clear either.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting. And it was, I actually had questions about that whole thing. But I guess if I understand what you're saying, what you might be saying is, when you reflect on Tenney's other lives, in some way that may help Tenney in the present moment.
Well, I'm saying then I see myself as a one.
Okay.
And one is eaten and one walks. And that to see that is important, I think. That's all.
Yeah. But you don't go back and try to live.
No, but so then you dive right back into the particular life you have, just like you dive right back onto the floor, or, you know, Frank O'Hara dives right back onto Second Avenue or something. You know.
So maybe what you're saying is or I'm wondering if what you're saying is you look at these, you know, past lives or routes you may have taken, which we probably all have many of, and but you're not rejecting those, but you're kind of including those.
Yeah.
You're not going, oh, that was such a terrible mistake.
No, not at all.
I don't
right.
want to be
yeah,
that
not
way
all.
Anymore.
Not at all.
You're
yeah.
acknowledging.
Yeah.
You're kind of
yeah.
in including that.
Yeah. And I guess I'm also trying to, I mean, mostly it seems really incredibly important to be engaged with the particulars of your own life, you know, and even attached to outcomes or not, but, you know, there's certain things you're intensely involved in, there's certain things you care about immensely. And at the same time, it seems to me, it seems important to just say, it's one life, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, one thing that came out of the vastness, mm-hmm. and it's going to go how it goes.
Yeah.
And in some sense, at the end of it, it's just like, it was, example's not even the right word, but it was just another life, you know? And
yeah.
and to see it from that large vantage, I think, is helpful.
Yeah.
You know? And again, you know, if the point were that then you get less involved in the particulars, you know, that wouldn't be it, you know? But it's a little bit like relative and absolute bodhicitta, is I guess what I'm saying.
I'm not sure I can, I keep thinking about what you're saying about, you know, being with others who are diving in, not being able, I mean, I relate to that very strongly. And there, it seems that the sort of not attached to the outcome is, if we become attached to the outcome, when we can't know anyway, there's so much we can't know, so say it that way. If we become, then we become part of what's the separation that's happening all over the place. We just are separating in this direction, and it's mm-hmm. going this direction, and we're part of that. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece that about this whole attachment to outcome, because we can't know. But it doesn't mean we're not engaged. So then it's the next question, which is, well, so what is my engagement? You know, how do I live? And I feel grateful that I have this practice to be in, because it's, you know, because we have things like not knowing is most intimate. There's these experiences that we've actually had in our bodies that we can draw upon. Somehow, and maybe someone else heard this, John Tarrant had one of his Monday or his first of the month talks. He said, because the world is going, I mean, this, I'm not going to say it as loudly, because the world is going crazy doesn't mean you have to go crazy. And then he said something like, and it was like, you know, do what you love. So be engaged in the way you love, which actually, in the this bigger context that we're talking about love, sounds actually like a much bigger idea. Mm. Do what you love. You may as well, because you can't do anything else, really. It's like, but do what you love. Now, what's particular to you and I is not going to be what is somebody else's manifestation of that.
Yeah.
So to compare ourselves, at least in terms of activism and what I used to be in, I used to be in the streets in this way, and I'm not going to do that in this way. I don't know, I'm going to have to find that, but that sort of thread of what's the thing that is particular to us, and that is part of the bigger love. It's like both those things happening at once, but I don't know if that's helpful. Somehow I heard when he said it, it was just like, there's something in that. And he said, and you may as well, because you can't do it any other way, really. There's nothing, the others are part of delusion. It's basically when you force something in a kind of activism, and certainly outcomes that I've pre-decided with knowing that this field is so much huger than anything that I can possibly grapple with. But it doesn't mean I don't grapple. It just means it's bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, thank you.
It's hard and important to talk about that.
Can I say one thing before?
Yeah.
First of all, it's Wuxian.
Right.
Going back to Miss Pong, it's like a microcosm. This koan is like a microcosm of koan work, in that your koan work is trying to elicit that. That initial response that comes from in here and not up here. And so it's in the moment. What is it in the moment? And for her, in that moment, it was boom, on the ground.
Yeah.
And I think that any kind of help that you give to somebody or find that you need to give to somebody comes from that right there in that moment. Yeah. And so all that thinking, what good is that when you've got your mind just going, what am I going to do? It gives you a base for all of that, It lets you draw from that.
Yeah.
That absolute,
Yeah.
And I'm saying that that's what I really like about the koan work, is that shifting you back and forth, that letting you get a taste of that something greater than your silly little thoughts.
Yeah, that's good.
And making your silly little thoughts better.
that's great. Yeah, that they get more responsive to that other thing. Yeah, instead of leading you away from it.
Maybe more receptive.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So that is one possible good place to end, though. I'll ask if there's anything else that must be said.
But, it's Joan, just sort of in the sense that, and you have to be fetchable. And you have to walk out the door to meet the world. I can't, it's like those two things. It's like I have to make myself available and I have to step outside.
Yeah.
After that, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But those things, you can't be, and that goes with this mind thing. You can't be sitting around, I can't be sitting around thinking about it all the time. It's like I have to walk out the
door. How do you respond?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just don't know until.
Yeah, that's what's so great about it.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. I guess we'll...
Do you want to just stay here rather than walking out and coming back?
Sure. Sure. One-stop shopping.
Yes.